Welcome to the second installment of Students for a Global Change. Today we will be talking about genetic engineering, and in a moment we will be talking to Ignacio Chapela, a former University of California, Berkeley professor who is currently in a legal battle surrounding his academic freedom.
A quiet change has occurred in farming practices used in the United States. Genetically engineered crops, or crops with transgenes, have made their way into conventional farming practices and are now being sold without government regulations or labeling requirements all across the nation. Few U.S. consumers know this. The European Union, on the other hand, has acknowledged the importance of putting labels on genetically modified foods so that consumers can make the informed decision of whether or not to purchase these items. This is important because genetically modified foods have been found to have detrimental effects on people's health. The food industry has mishandled this relatively new technology as well. Starlink corn, a genetically modified corn not approved for human consumption, was found to be in taco shells at supermarkets, in shells at Taco Bell, and also U.S. aid sent to Bolivia. There was a recall of over 300 food products between 2000 and 2001 involving Starlink corn. Genetically modified foods are also having negative impacts on farmers who do not even want to grow them. In 2001, Percy Schmeiser, a canola farmer in Canada, found out that his crops had been contaminated with a Roundup Ready transgene patented by the biotech corporation Monsanto. Instead of Monsanto being held responsible for the contamination, he was sued by the company for growing their patented crop, even though he was not using the technology. The cross-pollination of genetically modified crops with non-genetically modified crops is a threat to crop biodiversity and potentially food security because we do not know the long-term effects of this hazardous technology. We'll now turn our discussion to Ignacio Chapela, a former University of California, Berkeley professor denied tenure for calling attention to UC Berkeley's relationship with the biotech corporation Novartis. Novartis signed a 5-year contract to fund the school $25 million, which also ensured them first access to research done at UC Berkeley.
Thank you for joining us, Ignacio. Can you please give a brief overview of your studies in Mexico regarding genetically engineered corn? What were some problems, if any, that you ran into?
Yes, our study in Mexico was a very simple one. Technically speaking, it was simply the detection of bacterial and viral DNA within the genome of local land races of corn. It's very simple. It's simply the equivalent in biology of a Polaroid photograph, where you just go and see whether there's something, yes or no, and get that established. What is very complex and became even more after the discovery was the politics. First of all, the politics of who can ask these questions, who is able and politically able to ask this question, where are these genetically modified organisms going, who has the technical capacity to do it. And the amazing thing is that nobody had even looked, even though we had been discussing by that point about 20 years, there had been a big debate about whether genetically modified organisms would stay where they were put or they would spread all over the world. Nobody had actually looked at it. At that time, I had been working for about 15 years with a coalition of indigenous communities down in the state of Oaxaca in Mexico. And they were very interested in the problems of they're releasing these organisms into the environment. What's going to happen? Are they going to come to us? Even though they tell us they're not going to plant them around our areas, what if they get here? And who could possibly tell us when they get here? You go down the list and you ask the question, okay, is the industry who's producing them going to tell them? Of course not. They're not going to tell them when, you know, their beasties get out of control. Is then the government going to tell them? Maybe the U.S. government has these industries under control. And the answer is no. Well, how about the Mexican government? Well, the Mexican government has no interest in going against the U.S. government in that front. So the answer is no, the government is not going to do it. Well, then you always think academia. You know, there must be a university or somewhere with a lab that will be looking and will tell us that there is a problem. And the amazing thing is that after 20 years of talking about it and thinking it was an important thing to look into, nobody had done it. And academia is also not in the position to ask these questions because, as we found out, asking questions that are uncomfortable for this industry can be very, very, very expensive for your career and can be very expensive for your research monies and so on and so forth. So it ended up being an idea that we wanted to develop, and we wanted to enable these indigenous communities to be able to do themselves. We came to the conclusion, nobody's going to look for you. Unless you have the capacity, nobody's going to tell you. So my student, David Quist, and then my student, now he is Dr. Quist, was going to go and do a workshop to train people in the laboratory that we had already established years before. And he was going to run a trial. He was going to use positive controls. He brought some canned corn from the U.S. that we knew was transgenic. And for his negative controls, we started asking, well, where would you find totally clean, non-transgenic corn? Well, you would think we're going to find it exactly there. This is the cradle of corn. This is the place where we used to think we have the cleanest possible source of genetic diversity of corn. So, why not take your negative controls from there? So the amazing thing was that the surprise that when David ran that workshop, he started finding that his supposedly negative controls were showing up positive. And that's how, it was a little bit of serendipity. We were looking for it, but we found it earlier and in places that we really did not expect to see it.
What areas of yours and Quist's research were criticized and why?
We asked two questions. The first question is what I said before, a very simple, Polaroid photograph-like type of statement that is yes or no. Do you see them there or do you not see them there? And the answer is yes, we see them, and we see them very, very frequently. Beyond any reasonable doubt, we know that these transgenic pieces of DNA are within the genome of local land races of corn. That we know. We wanted to know, on top of that, where these pieces of DNA were inserted into the genome. So you have the whole mass of genes, if you will, of DNA within the corn plant, and these pieces of DNA are inserted into that. And we were very curious to find out where these pieces of DNA were. Why would we be? Would that be important? Well, this piece of DNA might have effects on the neighboring DNA within the genome. So knowing where they are could be important for that reason. But also, if we found several points of insertion, so if this piece of DNA were inserted in different places within the genome, that would give us evidence that there have been multiple events of contamination. Or that the single event of contamination has been reproducing in this uncontrollable way, has been jumping within the genome of corn and so on. You can imagine all kinds of consequences if you found this piece of DNA in many different locations within the genome. So the first statement in the paper was, they're there. The second statement was, where are they? Can we have some idea of where they are? For the first statement, we used, as I said, very solid, state-of-the-art but very middle-of-the-road techniques and methods that are very easily controllable, that you can say, within reason, this is absolutely a certainty. For the secondary statement, we use a method that was new at the time. It was only 2 years old. Very few people had used it. That's called inverse PCR or iPCR. That is very exploratory and speculative. What you get is simply a string of letters of DNA sequence that you have to go back to GeneBank, which is a collection of all the sequences that have been deposited in this international database, and try and find within that database, you try and find a sequence that looks like what you got. And from that, you have to interpret and you have to say, well, this looks like such and such a chromosome and such a location that does that in corn. But it also looks like something in humans, and it also looks like something in mice and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of interpretation involved. Whenever you have interpretation, you will have different ways of interpreting. As many people as will look at the evidence will interpret it in a different way. And that's exactly what happened. Some people came out and said, well, what they are saying is not right. Because this sequence, yeah, it could be that, but we believe it's more like that other thing. That's perfectly fine. It's a valid, legitimate technical challenge that goes with the terrain of speculation and interpretation. What was more interesting politically was that that commentary, that question, was beaten up to a froth, to the point that people were saying, well, there is a flaw, there is a technical flaw there that shows that these people don't know what they're doing, therefore the whole paper should be discounted, therefore this nobody should pay attention to what they say. So what was simply a small technical comment on a secondary statement was built as a commentary on the quality of my lab, on the integrity of my person and David Quist's person, as scientists and so on, and as a call to dismiss the paper entirely. So I think it's really important to recognize that there are these two very separate statements. The primary statement, there is contamination. To this day, nobody has proven it wrong. And on the contrary, everybody just takes it for granted. We know it's there.
How does genetically engineered corn get into a country such as Mexico where genetically engineered crop growing is prohibited?
You're perfectly right in pointing out that there used to be and still is a ban on the planting of transgenic corn in Mexico for the very reason that neither the Mexican government nor the international community wanted to have this happening. So the it begs the question, where would that contamination come from? The very strict answer to that question is we don't know. And it's a tragic answer because we should have been doing a lot more research on this and we are not doing it. I cannot do it because my work is put in question and nobody else wants to touch it with a 10-foot pole because they've seen how expensive it is to make any statements on this. So we don't know. However, there are ways in which this transgenic piece of DNA can get themselves into these most remote areas of Mexico and other countries that are really like the biological footprint of a vicious circle that connects you and me as taxpayers in the U.S. all the way to that problem and back here. Let me go through that cycle. First goes your tax money goes to subsidize the production of corn in the Midwest, where farmers produce corn and put it out in the market at below production cost. So the price that they put it out in the international market is below what they need to actually produce it. They're not making a profit. They would be losing money were it not for the subsidy that they receive from the government. So they flood the international market with that underpriced corn that is received into the developing world, let's say Mexico in this case, as subsidized corn that is further subsidized because Mexico uses money from international loans, the World Bank, all this development money goes into supporting a network of welfare food distribution, mostly corn and powdered milk. So this corn and powdered milk gets distributed, again subsidized, so that it reaches the most remote corners of the country as grain. Talking to farmers out there, they tell me that this corn reaches them in such a way that if they want to produce corn from their own seed, they have to subsidize it themselves at a tune of about 20 to 30% of the cost of production. They have to pay out of the pocket to be able to grow their own seed. So it's much cheaper for them to go to the local store and buy this underpriced seed and put it in the ground. Plant it and grow that. We have many interviews with farmers who say, yeah, that's what we do. So they're actually planting the seed directly in their fields where the land races are growing. And of course you would have cross-pollination from those plants. So we have direct evidence that this is happening. It's also possible that you could have movement through migratory birds and insects that come back and forth between the Midwest of the U.S. and South of Mexico, through people moving pollen or moving seed across the border. There's so much traffic of people, trucks, and so on and so forth. It would be very easy to have that. But I think the main route is most likely going to be this route. You would ask the question, well, how is it? You have a contradiction between the laws that are trying to prevent this transgenic corn from being planted in Mexico, and the fact that it's actually being planted there. And you would say, well, who's responsible for this? It turns out that nobody wants to take responsibility for it. The people who ship it out of here, they say, well, it's properly labeled. It's labeled as grain, not seed. So we would never expect anyone to plant this. But the problem is that they don't realize that down there, there's no difference between grain and seed. You know, people eat what they plant and they plant what they eat. So it's bound to happen. And as long as we have this incredible outpouring of subsidized, contaminated corn into the world, this is really bound to happen. The Union of Concerned Scientists ran a study last year precisely looking at U.S. and closer to the main, you know, mainland production distribution system. And they find that for soybeans, for canola, and for corn, which is the only things they tested, that there is very high levels of contamination. So even what people are receiving, you know, farmers are buying as supposedly non-transgenic, is contaminated at incredibly high rates, sometimes up to 80% of the seed that they're buying is contaminated.
What are people in Mexico doing to secure the crop diversity? Are there any organizations helping them, or are there any efforts for that?
Yeah, of course, this is an urgent question, and there it's very frustrating to see how little is being done. Our discovery was in the year 2000. It was published in 2001. So it's already years since now in 2005. And the amazing thing is that nobody's really doing anything that would really put a dent onto the inflow of transgenic corn into Mexico. Hundreds of thousands of people are upset, and they have come out on the streets, and farmers organizations and indigenous organizations and citizens organizations have complained. Yet the government seems to be either unable or unwilling to do anything about it. One of the big problems is that in order to prevent this, once you know where it's coming from, you would just simply have to stop importing corn from the U.S. You would simply have to go against NAFTA. And, you know, you can imagine what that means politically, economically, in terms of who knows when the U.S. would allow this to happen, you know, and how far we in the U.S. would go to prevent Mexico from, you know, negating some of the basic premises of NAFTA. However, in the last year and a half or so, there have been many small-scale, very locally organized initiatives to do something about this. There are efforts at the state level, for example, in Oaxaca and Chiapas. The legislatures have passed legislation calling the state of Oaxaca, for example, a repository of genetic diversity of corn for humanity. So that is probably going to at least put some brakes, and it's going to be an interesting development, see how the federal versus the state powers are going to play out. That, of course, the state would never do were it not for the fact that there is incredible pressure from the grassroots up. So there are many germplasm banks, local germplasm banks, indigenous-run germplasm banks, where seed collections are being gathered. School systems are being deployed to keep the local seed alive and the local diversity alive. Some international support has come to their aid, even though, as I said, it's small and locally organized, which is what you would expect to happen. But I think there's a very big need for international recognition of what's happening here. You know, these people are very poor. They hardly have any cash whatsoever. Well, the little amount of cash they have is because they send their people over here to work on what? In agriculture. So they can send remittances back there, and that's the money they have. And they are using that money to save their seed. But I think it's really important that we recognize internationally that what they're doing there is an incredibly important job for the rest of the world. They have been put to compete with, you know, tractors and industrial farming and soil and water mining in the Midwest for production of biomass of corn. And I think it would be really important that we recognize them as producers or keepers of diversity, not biomass, and that we revalued, applied a much higher value to diversity than what we're doing today. We just take it for granted. We just assume that they are going to do that job and that we can go there and gather it whenever we want. Whenever we have a big epidemic here, we'll be able to go down there and get those genes that they're keeping. Why not pay for that? Why not revalue that job of keeping diversity?
What is your personal position on genetic engineering?
At this point, my position is really against any development of transgenic organisms, not out of any principled moral or ethical principles. And I very much respect people who take that position, you know, out of principle, not to mess with nature or not to do things that some people consider only the realm of God's doing, that type of thing. I don't come to this problem from that perspective. My perspective is really just biological. I think we know enough now to know that, number one, this is all really out of control, that once you put an organism out in the environment, it's going to go places that we cannot predict, and it's going to do things that we cannot predict. Number two, we also know enough to know that almost every single one of the manipulations that we've introduced through transgenesis carries with it risks that the very few experiments that have been done show that we should be worried about them. So I don't see any organism out there that I would like to see released in the open public environment. And number three, for no purpose. There's nothing out there that I have heard of, that I have heard people dream of or anything, that carries any benefit for the public in general. There's always the promise. You know, they keep saying, well, give us some more money and give us some more time and we'll deliver something amazing. We don't even know what it is, but it's going to be really amazing. And that kind of, you would give them the benefit of the doubt at some point. But this has been going on for a quarter century, 25 years, almost as old as you are probably, or, you know, older than you are. We've given them $220 billion. For what? For this. So even though I could have given it the benefit of the doubt a quarter century ago, before we put so much money into it and so on, and I would have said back there, under incredibly tight, controlled, restricted, no-release conditions, seriously controlled biosafety labs. And that, I don't know, because I've worked in biosafety three labs, and I know that you do have releases from there. You know, they're not perfect. Even though I would have given them the doubt then, today, 25 years down the line, I don't. So I think it is really high time that we stop, that we reconsider whether we want them in the first place, whether we have no other alternative, and we have not looked even at the beginning of the alternatives, and then have a very open and very public and very transparent and very well thought out process through which people can decide whether we should go there or not. We didn't do it, and I think it's time to just call it back.
I'm really curious, in your past with Sandoz, what were your specific tasks, how long you were there, and what were their motives?
I worked at Sandoz, which later became Novartis when it merged with Ciba Geigy, from, let me see if I get this right, 1987 to 91, or 80, yeah, I think it was 87 to 91, 3 years. It was a time when the biotech industry was emerging. It was very, very dynamic, but it was outside of these large corporations. We were watching the industry develop like that from inside. And I remember being puzzled, even though I had nothing to do with acquisitions or anything, I was puzzled by the fact that we were not developing any biotech within the company. And then finally I understood what the game was about. You know, what you do as a big corporation is that you let the little guys out there take the risk. You know, you have people from universities and young people with, you know, great ideas, and you have them go file the patents, take the risks, and show whether whether their products are going to work or not. And then what you do is just buy them in. You just buy the winners of that race, you know, and all the losses just get washed out into the population. So I think that's what I think Santos was doing at the time about biotechnology. My job there was a very open-ended one. At that time, for my PhD thesis, I had, I don't know if I should say discovered, but I was working with a group of fungi, microorganisms, microscopic fungi, that very few people knew about, that very few people even knew that they existed. These are fungi that live within healthy tissues of plants. You know, basically every plant that you see around has these fungi inside them, even though they're healthy. And I had methods to isolate them, to bring them into culture, and so on and so forth. So Santos called me one day. I was living in Ithaca, New York, as a postdoc at Cornell University. And they called one day and they said, you know, we've been reading what you're writing and we've been hearing about your work. And we're wondering if you wouldn't want to come here and do whatever it is that you're doing, but just do it here. And it was the weirdest question, you know, and the weirdest proposition. But I ended up taking it. I'm not going to go into all the details of how I came to this decision. But I ended up taking it, and it was very free, actually, at the beginning. I was free to do my research on these fungi, which I thought was very important, as long as I gave them access to the fungi themselves so that they could test them for potential pharmaceuticals or agrochemicals. So it was really the remains of my work that they would pick up, take, and start testing. So that was my job. I was working in what was called the lead finding unit. So I was in touch a lot with the people who are right at the bottom of the discovery process, where you go and you try and discover new compounds from nature to develop into new drugs or, you know, pharmaceuticals or agrochemicals. And through that, I learned a lot about the whole field of bioprospecting, biopiracy, depending on what you want to call it. And I was very much part, as soon as I left Sandoz, I was very much part of the discussion and the politics and policy making around this question of who owns these things, you know. Things meaning living things. How is it that we pass from nature to natural resources, right? For many people, living organisms are just nature. They're out there. And then all of a sudden, people start coming in and saying, well, you know, but you can make money out of them. And all of a sudden, they become natural resources. And then all these questions start arising as to, you know, who owns them? Are they good for humanity or the people who own the land? Or the people who have used them for longest, or the people who know the most about them. So there are all these layers of questions that I started dealing with from Sandoz, but then I really kind of plunged into as soon as I left Sandoz.
Recently, you were denied tenure at UC Berkeley. Can you talk a little bit about the specifics behind this and a basic outline of what tenure is and an update on your current legal battle?
I guess I'll start with just saying what tenure is. Tenure is something very specific to the academic world, and it is the promise by your colleagues within a university that you are not going to be kicked out of your job. It is a device that was developed back in the 13th century as a measure to protect the free speech and the free thinking of scholars, so that you would be able to critique and criticize whatever you thought was important or say whatever you thought was important without fear of being, you know, having retaliation for saying something. So being a measure of protection for free speech and free thought and free publication and so on is something that is coveted a lot. Unfortunately, today I think it is coveted much more as simply job security. I have got a job that is I'm going to milk until retirement, right? And it's very interesting. I've heard this from, you know, older people than myself, where they say it is quite interesting to note that people who become tenure usually don't need the tenure because By the time you get to the point of being chosen for tenure or evaluated for tenure, the system today screens against those people who would most need tenure. And I think that's what's happened to me. I think that I'm being screened out as somebody who, once tenured, would give too much trouble, would speak up against interests that are not supposed to be touched, interests that are commercial, but also political, interests of friendship and academic commitment. For example, our universities, this university here, the whole University of California system, plunged into this idea that the only way to deal with biology was going to be through molecular biology. Biology for them now represents simply molecular biology, ecological sciences, organismic sciences, physiological sciences, and so on, are being pushed aside by this molecular biology way of understanding life. So speaking up against that way of understanding biology is not accepted, even if there was no money involved. The problem is that there is also a lot of money involved. There is money coming in from corporations. There's money coming in from directly as grants or gifts or things like that. But there's also alliances, contracts, agreements signed with these corporations that give them priority rights over intellectual property, over access to students, over access to designing research programs and the research direction for the university and so on. And there is also money, and this is very interesting. The university has become a money-making enterprise. In the U.S., this happened since the 1982 passage of the Bayh-Dole Act. The Bayh-Dole Act allows universities and federal institutions to patent and profit from the patents of the discoveries made within their halls. So that in a fell swoop, professors became entrepreneurs, money-making bodies for the university as a money-making enterprise. Students became employees of those entrepreneurs, and the whole thing was subverted into a money-making enterprise in such a way that there is now very little difference. It's very difficult to distinguish the boundaries between where a corporation, profit-making corporation outside the university starts, and where the academic corporation of the university begins. And they have been grafted at the hip. A really serious tragedy, I think, that we have today, for which tenure should protect you, but it doesn't. Some people say I should have waited to say what I had to say until I was tenured. And they could be right, but I do believe that if you're not going to say what you have to say before tenure, you won't say it after tenure. And you'll become one of those people that has tenure but doesn't really deserve it. I think that's something that is a privilege that the public had given us, academicians, to serve the public, has been totally abused and is considered to be a right. You know, people consider it to be a right to be tenured. The same thing, people consider the universities have the privilege that the public gives them to operate in more or less secrecy or privacy, so that they're not really held to the same standard, legal standards, as anybody else outside the university. That is a privilege. The university, I think, has abused it as a right, and they believe that they have the right to secrecy, to shut people out from the decision-making within the university, just because it's their right. So I think the university has been driven to a place where it's impossible to recognize what it's supposed to have been, a place of open discourse, a place of open questioning, a place where people were supposed to ask questions without fear and find the answers and say those answers in public without fear of retribution. That place doesn't exist anymore. And that's what I want to see with my challenge to this tenure decision. It's not really a challenge to the tenure decision, but it's a challenge to the whole story of my case at Berkeley. It's an eight-year-old story. It's a story where I claim that I'm being punished for two things. First, for speaking out against the signing of an agreement between the university and Novartis. At that time, it was the second largest corporation agrochemical and pharmaceutical. And then for the discovery of this problem with corn in Mexico and the publication of it, I think those two things are being punished. There is a very clear message that is being sent out to young scientists, to young people, not to ask questions, not to ask uncomfortable questions, and not to find the uncomfortable answers. So I find it really important that people see that this is challenged and that people see the truth behind all this, that it's not about the quality of my work, it's not about me even, but it's about the corruption and the subversion of the university and the whole scientific establishment.
In your opinion, what needs to happen in the future regarding genetic engineering?
Yeah, with regards of genetic engineering in the public domain, I think it's a great battle because it's very winnable. There is nothing out there that is interesting, that makes money. This is an industry in incredible disarray that, were it not for the subsidies that it receives from all of us, it would not be here. We would just not be doing what we're doing. And, you know, I could quote the numbers and show you. I'm going to be showing some numbers in my lecture today. However, it is an industry that is subsidized. We in California have just passed a Proposition 71 where we gave the same people $6 billion in just tax money. At the time that we're closing schools, that we're sacking teachers, that we're ransacking the environment, that we are, you know, spreading toxics to our populations, we give them a gift again of $6 billion. So I think it's really important that people see. You know, the first thing I think to do is that people should hear about what's happening and how they're being duped. You know, I don't think there's any better way of referring to what's happening in terms of public perception of this. What you're doing here is, I think, a really important thing, that you're letting people see what's happening. The U.S. is particularly bad at this. The discovery of the corn contamination in Mexico was covered front cover of Newsweek International, so it went around the world except for the U.S. Newsweek U.S. did not have a single line on it. New York Times told me, we know about it, we're not going to cover it. So there is something going on in the U.S. that people just need to, you know, clamor for information and hear about it. Very important immediate task is to get these things labeled. That's a very easy thing that it stands to just the simplest reason that if you're going to receive something that you might or might not want, you should have a label so that you can make a decision. And industry has fought labeling terribly. So simply knowing. I think if people really knew and saw what's happening, they would simply pull the support away from them and they wouldn't be with us. It's not such a difficult battle, really. It's not like the battle against the plundering of Alaska for oil or the mining of mountain tops and mining of soil and water and so on. Those are really difficult battles because there's a lot of money being made. In this battle, there's nothing to show for it. And people just have to be shown that the emperor has no clothes, and it's going to be very clear.
Thank you for coming, Ignacio.
Thank you for doing this.
For more information on Ignacio Chapela, visit tenuredjustice.org.
Students for a Global Change is a coalition of students from the Cascadia region. This program was put together by Caitlin, Jonathan, Colleen, Caleb, and Ryan. Good day.